Sometimes it can take just a smile from a stranger or a chance meeting with an acquaintance that can snap you out of a lull. Either a lack of inspiration or, frankly, when you're feeling fed up with life. And sometimes those meetings can be just the spark you need to plough on to make a change or fully embrace the fuck it moment mentality. And that's what happened to me when I received a phone call offering me the opportunity to meet today's guest, Chris Labby. It was my bank manager, Janine, who introduced me to Peter, who's a theatre director and an education specialist, and they told me why he's creating a musical all about Chris's life. So thanks to both of them for making this chat happen. I love how random life can be. Sometimes you connect people to the most randomest of sources. And how often is it that you get to meet someone whose job for 9 years was to protect Nelson Mandela? Well, it's a job that saw Chris Labby travel the world, dance with Princess Diana, be blessed by Pope John Paul II. But Chris is so much more than an ex-bodyguard to the former president of South Africa. In this conversation, we talk around themes of hope, torture, justice, forgiveness, as well as touching on the impact of important political movements over the 80s and 90s across Africa and the world. So it seems apt that we start from the beginning, which for Chris was pretty humble.
My first memories of where I realized that, you know, life had a twist to it was when I was 6 years old. When my parents were subsistence farmers growing up in South Africa. And one day my friend and I were playing in the cornfields where we lived, and these two men, white men from the government, came and they were looking around, making notes. One had a clipboard, talking to each other. And then they came to see my parents and gave us the news that really surprised us all. They said to us, look, this land that you are currently living on, which was ancestral land, has now been declared a white area and you've got 7 days to leave.
Wow.
And so we didn't have any recourse to the law. My parents were shocked because it was land that had been inherited, passed down through generations. And then 7 days later, policemen came with guns and we were taken forcibly off the land and taken to Durban, where I grew up as a young child. And for me, that was the earliest realization that I was living in a very, very strange land where people were treated really differently because of skin color. Mm. And so that's my earliest encounter of how different life was for us as a family.
How many were there in your family?
We're a family of 10, and I was the youngest. And my older brothers and sisters, some of them were at home, but others were working out far away. And so everybody came back and helped and chipped in, and very reluctantly we moved, and we ended up living in Durban, where I grew up as a young boy. And we lived in a shanty town because we had no home, and the government didn't build homes for non-white people in South Africa. So, you know, we were literally homeless. And so my parents and my dad and my older brothers ended up building us a shack, and that's where we ended up living. Mm. And that became home, but it was an awful existence because there was no running water, no electricity, no toilets, and no facilities for children, no football fields, nothing. So a very, very bleak existence, really. And that was my early recollections of growing up and coming to terms with this whole idea of apartheid and what it was all about.
Do you look back on that time How do you look back on that time? Do you wonder how you and your family got through it? Or was it a case of, this is the card we've been dealt and we have to carry on?
I look at it as the card that we were dealt. This is the card that we were dealt, and we had to just live with it and get through it. And I think had it not been for parents who, had a very, very good upbringing, good values, and who kept on believing that things will get better, I don't think we would have got through it, or personally I would have got through it as an individual. But I think we always resorted to my parents' amazing values of believing that something good will come out of this at some point, even though it took almost a lifetime for it to happen.
Yeah.
And so there was nothing you can do about it. Like I said, there was no recourse to the law. You couldn't challenge the decision in court, because the whole justice system was skewed towards white judges, white prosecutors, and you just knew you'd never have a fair trial. And so there was nothing you could really do or say about it and get along with it. And of course, I discovered that there were millions of people in exactly the same position as us. Mm-hmm. We were not unique. So there were probably about 60 million other people in exactly the same position.
People use the word hope sometimes in these situations. Was that a word that you pondered over at all at that time?
Yes. It was one that I clung to. And in fact, my dad always said to us, we always need to cling to hope. Even though, strangely enough, we ended up living in a shanty town called A Place of No Hope.
Really?
Ironically. And so my dad always, spoke about just hoping and believing. And, one of my best friends when I was growing up on the farm, his name was Temba, which means to give hope.
Really?
And there I ended up in this place called A Place of No Hope, and with the dad who kept saying, let's just keep believing that things would get better. So I trusted and believed and clung to hope and felt at some point quite let down by the fact that things didn't quite go my way. As a family, we didn't really see the fruition of this clinging to hope for a very, very long time.
The idea of white areas, black areas, the public transport, apartheid, and living through those years, just give us a sense of some of the examples where you saw. I mean, did you, as a child, step into a white area without knowing? And what were the consequences when things like that happened?
Yes, I remember when I was about, I must have been about 14 years old, when we went to the beach. And of course, there were these signs everywhere, on buses, on coaches, on trains, that had separate buses for whites, separate buses for non-whites, and first-class coaches for whites and third-class coaches for non-whites. And so one day we went to the beach and we really wanted to swim in this tidal pool, and we were not allowed to. And so my friend and I decided, well, we're just going to go and swim.
Yeah.
And of course, lots of white people complained, and the police eventually came. And so we thought, well, we'll just stay in the water, not realizing that at some point we'll have to get out. So the police came and managed to get us out the water. They sent people in and got us out, and we were beaten up quite badly by the policemen for disobeying the law.
Wow.
And so it became quite apparent that the government took breaking the law quite seriously. And so I began to realize that apartheid is a reality, and it's something that we're going to have to live with. But I didn't think that we would, I didn't believe that I needed to be tolerant of it at all, and that something could be done to bring about change.
Mm-hmm. I think I read somewhere about an example where you were trying to care for your mom, and she had had, was it a diabetes attack?
Yes.
When you were on a bus. Just explain what happened there.
Yeah, we were traveling on a bus one day, and we were going into the city where we lived in Durban, and then my mom started to feel dizzy and like she needed desperately to get, she's feeling weak. And of course, obviously this all predates mobile phones. And so I couldn't take out my iPhone and make a call to 999, for instance. The only way to really get help was to ring the bell. And so I pressed the bell once, twice, third time, and of course, thinking that the bus would stop, but it didn't. And so I went to speak to the driver, and I said, look, my mom's very ill, she's diabetic, and she's starting to feel dizzy. Do you mind just stopping the bus so we could get help? And of course, the driver said to me, look, I'm so sorry to tell you, I'm not allowed to drop you off, because at the moment we're traveling through a whites-only area. And if I do that, you'd get into trouble, I'll lose my job, you'll get arrested maybe with the police for being there. And so eventually when we got into the city, he stopped the bus and helped me, him and other passengers, to get my mom off the bus. The only problem was he stopped the bus not far from a whites-only bench. And I instinctively knew that my mom was not going to sit on the bench, because we were coloured. And we were not allowed to sit on a whites-only bench. And of course, the driver had other ideas, and he felt that my mom was diabetic, she needed to sit down. And so they got her to sit on the bench. And of course, there were many, many passengers in the bus, and people were desperate to get to their destinations. So the driver had to leave, and he eventually left, and the police came. I was alone with my mom, and so she was lifted off the bench and thrown onto the pavement.
Wow.
And that was at the age of 8. And I began to realize, well, this is can't be right. This is not right the way, you know, your own mom gets treated. And so I suppose the activist in me was born that day. And from then on, obviously my mom was taken to hospital eventually, slipped into a coma, spent 3 months in hospital, and miraculously came out of the coma, which was a real miracle. But that was the catalyst for change, and I knew then that something had to be done about this system. And so I started to, as I got older, started to push the boundaries, started to, when I got to high school, organize peaceful protests, became a full-blown activist and organized marches, and of course got into trouble with the police, and the army would come in and we would get beaten up and spent time in prison, was arrested. And that therein, I suppose, was the beginning of this new life, this new persona where I would try to defeat this enemy called apartheid.
What did your parents think as you were going out as a youngster and campaigning? Did they want you to perhaps take the quiet life, or were they supportive of you standing up against, well, such strong forces?
My dad was extremely supportive of what I was doing, but my mom was a bit more, I think, having had that, you know, that experience of seeing and feeling the force of the law must have really shaken her, where she felt maybe it was not a good idea to challenge the system, because there was a lot of consequences to it. But my dad felt that, you know, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And so he was very, very supportive. And but he always believed in peace, my father. He never wanted violence. He didn't want us to take up arms or get aggressive or anything. He believed, he was a strong student of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, And so he believed in passive resistance, and that's a way of getting rid of conflict. And so they were extremely supportive, but my mom was a bit wary and skeptical because
that's
of
what moms are for.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You went on to continue your activism, and you became a wanted man and ended up facing prison time. Just kind of recap for us that those years where it became a little bit more serious for you, didn't it?
Yes. When I finished high school, it was my dream to become a pilot. I had this dream of becoming flying all over the world.
Wow.
And never got to fulfill my dream because, again, I was denied the opportunity because I was the wrong skin color.
Right.
And so I was really disappointed. So eventually I traveled to Cape Town. I became a full-blown activist, got more immersed myself in marches, organizing protests. And of course, this is a point where I met Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and he would join in the marches with us, and we would go onto the streets, and we would go onto the beaches. And
were they peaceful?
They were always peaceful, but of course, whenever the state would send in the army and the police, they became violent because they used not just tear gas, but they would shoot at people. So many, many people lost their lives. It became a dangerous thing to do, and you knew that you could probably end up dead because it was so dangerous. And at the same time, the state had this... they were looking at ringleaders, people that were organizing marches, and they would organize hit squads that would have you taken out, literally.
Wow.
And so many, many people went missing, some were killed, and we always knew it was the hand of the state that was trying to prevent people from standing up. But of course, many of us did, and I evaded the police for a very, very long time, became a wanted person. And so I never really stayed in one house for more than 2 days at a time. And eventually, one of my very, very good friends was murdered. He was killed by the police. He was an activist too. And of course, I knew now that there's a bullet with my name on. And so I eventually went to live in Botswana and Tanzania and Zambia for a period of a year. And never came back, literally became a refugee.
Because how old were you at this point?
I was probably about 18 years old.
Wow.
And after I left my parents' home, I was not to see my parents for a period of 10 years because the police were looking for me. And my father had sent a message to say, don't come back home because the police are hunting for you.
Mm.
And so I lived in exile for a year and then snuck back into the country. And literally the day after I came back into Cape Town, was arrested and taken to prison. They finally caught up with me, tortured, waterboarded, beaten up, questioned, and sentenced to a year's imprisonment.
So when you came back to Cape Town, you almost knew that that was going to happen to you. What was the trigger within you that thought, no, I've got to face this now, I've got to go back?
The trigger in me was the fact that I kept looking at news reports of what was taking place in South Africa. And also, at that particular time, the winds of change were blowing in the world. Soviet Union had just collapsed. The Berlin Wall had just fallen. So we felt that change was literally on the horizon. We could feel it. We could touch it. Freedom was in the air.
Mm.
There was rumors that the government was going to release Nelson Mandela, but that never quite happened. So I wanted to be part of that, bringing that quickly. Because I'd felt that too many people had died, and I thought that a life lived in exile was a bit too cushy and soft, and I was not being very productive I could have done a whole lot more back home and organized. So I snuck back in, and of course, that's how I ended up in prison.
Was there any point, we'll talk about some of the things that happened whilst you're in prison in a moment, but did you feel afraid? You know, some of the things that you had already experienced, even up to that point, sound quite horrifying. Were there times where, when you were alone and you sat with these memories, that it could feel overwhelming?
Yes, I mean, there were many, many times when, particularly in prison, where I felt like I would be killed. They would just kill me and nobody would know.
Yeah.
And because that's what they did. And it was a scary, terrifying ordeal. And they would play mind games. They would come in and they would say things like, oh, we just wanted to tell you your mom and your dad were just killed in a car crash.
Wow.
And then they would, you know, I would just be in floods of tears, and they'd come back a week later and say, oh, no, sorry, we were just joking. You know, so they would play these constant mind games. And so you knew that this sort of mindset that they had, where they were given this freedom by the apartheid regime to do whatever they wanted to do, to get whatever they wanted out of you, which there was nothing to get. I was just somebody driven by, you know, I felt that, like Martin Luther King said, that all people are free. And I wanted the same freedom that the white people had in South Africa. And of course, knew that it would be a dangerous preoccupation. And so I was driven by the fact that there were many, many people who had given their lives. And I knew at any point that I could get killed. I mean, it's interesting. It's in Nelson Mandela's speech during sentencing, in the statement that before being sentenced, he said, freedom is an ideal that he's prepared to live for, but if necessary, it's one that he's prepared to die for. And I almost felt like exactly the same thing, because, you know, I just felt of generations to come, how long do we have to tolerate this, you know, this being treated like second-class citizens?
Mm.
And if I didn't stand up, if others didn't stand up, and many lost their lives, then nothing would change.
Yeah.
And it's like that with life even today. Mm. I think we've got to stand up and be counted. We can't just, you know, say, well, things have to change. And I constantly hear the same refrain of people saying, well, I don't know what to do. And we live in this digital age where people can do things. They can tweet, or they can write emails to their MPs and bring about change. And so we can all do something. And I felt that this is the least that I could do.
Yeah. There was an incident whilst you were in prison where the guards played Russian roulette.
Yes, they. One evening they came into the prison cell and said, right, we're going to play this game called Russian roulette. Held a gun to my head, and I didn't know about it. Put a bullet in the revolver. Said, right, you've got to pull the trigger. And I thought, well, this is it. I'm going to die tonight. And of course, the thought crossed my mind, should I just pull the, you know, aim the gun at one of them maybe and take one of them out? But then I thought, well, if it doesn't go off, I'll be in a lot of trouble.
Mm.
And of course, I kept holding the gun to my head. And there was one white prison warder was betting that the gun wouldn't go off, and the others were all betting it would. And the guy who was betting that it wouldn't go off seemed to be winning all the money. They were betting real money. And there I was holding this gun to my head and pulling the trigger. And of course, there was a point where the bullet was in line with the chamber of the gun. I thought, here's my chance to take one of them out.
How did you know that?
Because I could feel, and out of the corner of my eye, I could see the bullet. Literally could see when I looked. I could feel, and of course, when I'm holding the trigger, I could feel there's a bullet.
It felt different.
It felt different to the rest of the times. And of course, I decided, well, I'm not going to aim it at one of them. I'm going to hold it to my head, pull the trigger, and the entire Ganges jammed. And
my God.
And, and that was quite a relief when the gun jammed. And of course, just then, a riot broke out in the prison, and I was taken back to my cell. And I somehow knew, a voice told me that day that you're not going to die. And I knew that I was going to live through this and see freedom. And I did. I got out of there a year after my year sentence and organized another march. And of course, President F.W. de Klerk became president. His predecessor had been taken very ill. And the next thing, he released Nelson Mandela.
Mm.
And, you know, suddenly now, Nelson Mandela walks out on the, you know, 11th of February, 1990.
I'm one of those.
New chapter. I'm standing there with the rest of the people, don't know him. And it's almost like all of us walked out of prison that day, 60 million of us.
Mm.
And he came out of prison, and it was an amazing time from then on.
Did you reconnect with your family then as well, and and your brothers and sisters, and were they still living in Ashanti Town, or what had happened when you returned to meet them?
Some of them had moved on and had got rental homes, and there was nobody living in the shanty town anymore. Things seemed to get slightly better under F.W. de Klerk when he became president. And so I reconnected with them after the very, very long period of absence, which was an amazing time because I hadn't seen them. My mom was very, very ill at this point, with obviously a lot of it with the worry, and, you know, got to talk to them. And, of course, this was the point where I met Nelson Mandela after his release, started working with him. He was fascinated by my height and the size of my shoes.
You might need to paint the picture there. How tall are you and what size shoe are you?
I'm 6'3" and I take size 14.
Okay.
And that really caught his eye. And so he asked me to come and work with him as a bodyguard, which obviously was never on my bucket list, and started working with him. And
so you go from being in a jail cell where you're being tortured, waterboarded, to this huge swathe of change in the country. And it was by chance, wasn't it, that you ended up working or meeting Nelson Mandela? Was it at the phone call where he needed your help that kind of ignited the kind of relationship that you would have with him moving forwards?
Yes, I was based in Cape Town. He was in Johannesburg, and I was in charge of setting up IT systems and sorting out the logistics, the office furniture, etc. And then he phoned up one day asking what we needed. And I was just about to tell him, and he had to go off to a meeting urgently, and he asked me to come and see him at his office.
Yeah.
And that meeting, that chance meeting, where he was fascinated by my height and the size of my shoes, was what was the catalyst that changed everything. And I started working with him. He asked me to work with him, and I just couldn't turn it down because he's one of my greatest heroes. And I started working with him and suddenly found myself in negotiations. I was this guy that lived in a shanty town. Now suddenly I'm talking and discussing the future of the country.
Mm.
And part of this whole process, which was quite intriguing.
So you worked as his bodyguard. What kind of training did you have to go through? Because you did have to be, you were armed as well, weren't you?
Yes, we were trained by the SAS. We were trained by the British SAS, and we were trained, you know, physically how to handle arms, but most of all about communication. And of course, you know, the SAS training is not easy. It's very, very difficult.
What do you have to do?
I mean, the things that you see on television where you have to jog for like 20 kilometers and with a rucksack and no water. And it's all about survival. And they put you in different scenarios, like you've been kidnapped or the person you're protecting is being kidnapped. And what do you do? And they've got proper helicopters that come in and they simulate a terrorist attack. And you've literally, you know, got to fight your way out of it.
Yeah.
And but most of all, it was all about communication and understanding how to control people. And of course, what was more interesting is you're looking after this person who doesn't want you to brandish a gun or chase people away, or and who really wanted us to smile all the time because he believed that we represented him. So it was an incredible experience, you know, working with him.
Mm. Along your time whilst you, worked with him, who were some of the people that you met, and where did that job take you?
Well, we visited many, many parts of the world, including the White House. We spent the weekend at the White House. I got to meet the Queen. I met the British Prime Minister, and, you know, just met some incredible, very, very famous musicians. I don't want to drop any names because that's just not my way of doing things.
But
met some really amazing, amazing people that you could literally only just dream about. I got to meet probably one of the most amazing one was Pope John Paul II, who I met. Nelson Mandela got me to tell him my story, and he was really fascinated. And he said to me, one day you're going to go around all the world telling your story. And I never, ever forget that experience. And of course, Her Majesty the Queen was quite amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I was quite amazed at how much she knew about what was happening in the world. And so suddenly I found myself being moved, going around traveling the world. And that was just a dream when I was growing up. But most of all, I think the best part of the whole job was learning from this amazing man and learning, you know, brilliant lessons, life lessons, which is sort of is informed my life today and what I do, going around speaking to teachers, students, corporate environments, and just sharing some of his ideals and values and just encouraging people never to give up.
A big lesson that you learnt working with Mr. Mandela was forgiveness.
Yes, yes.
Because you met a man who had almost killed you. You were within seconds of dying when he waterboarded you, and suddenly you found yourself serving alongside him as another one of Nelson Mandela's bodyguards. How did that come around, and how did you feel initially when that guy was appointed?
Well, initially, when he walked into the room, we were all sitting in the room. He and three others walked in, and we were really annoyed to see them because they were the enemy, really. They worked on the other side. It was their job to hunt us down and kill us. And yeah, Nelson Mandela was inviting them to come and work with us as fellow bodyguards, and we were not really in the mood to work with them. And of course, Nelson Mandela started to introduce us to the whole idea of forgiveness, because he had come out of prison after 27 years, and the first thing he says to his oppressors and the people that treated him badly is, "I forgive you." And he expected all of us to do the same. And we were really in no mood because we had seen firsthand how brutal these guys were. And the guy that I ended up working with is the guy who was one of those who tortured me in prison. And my immediate instincts when I met him was to blow his head off.
You were armed, obviously.
I was armed. Yeah.
Part of your job.
Wanted revenge, you know. But of course, Nelson Mandela wanted to have nothing to do with revenge because he felt that, you know, an eye for an eye will just make the world go blind. And that, you know, life lived without forgiveness is like living in a prison. And so he started to teach us about forgiving. And I learned very, very slowly. It took me a long, long time. And eventually I was able to forgive the man. And him and I became very, very good friends. We're still very good friends today. I'm a godfather to his son. And
so
it does work. And of course, you can't argue with a man who had lived it for 27 years. He'd been deprived of his life and then comes out of prison and he's able to forgive. So you can't really argue with that.
Yeah. There was a ceremony, wasn't there, where you had to wash each other's feet, you and the gentleman. You forgiving him or him accepting your forgiveness? Is that how this works?
No, what had happened was he had invited me without telling me what was going to happen to a ceremony, and I didn't know what I was going to. And of course, his family were all white and his friends were all there, and he got me to sit in front of the church. And so he took off my shoes and brought a bucket of basin of water, warm water, and he washed my feet. And then he asked me, he said to me, look, now can you forgive me?
Wow.
Because there'd been 5 years, and I said, yes, I can. You know, this is probably one of the most humane or a sign of humility for me. And so I did exactly the same, washed his feet, and we're able to forgive each other and
move forward.
Moved forward, you know, which is quite an important lesson, I think, in life even today, because I think a lot of people harbor grudges. But I mean, it doesn't mean that if we forgive, we forget. No, because those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. So it's very, very important for us to, you know, forgive, but never forget what had happened in the past.
Did he ever talk about, from his perspective, what it had been like being someone who did the torturing? Were you ever able to have that conversation and hear from him as well?
Yes, we did. South Africa was undergoing, often during Nelson Mandela's first year, he introduced the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And this was headed by chaired by Desmond Tutu. And during that process, we were able, the entire country, if you had any, you could make a submission to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for any atrocities that had been committed, and people who were involved would be subpoenaed. So ordinary citizens were given a chance, and it was a very, very bleak period because this was in open display. There was no hidden hearings. It was broadcast live on television. And so I made a submission, and he was able to say who gave him orders, and that went right up the chain, and the government minister had to come and answer from the previous government. And again, it was interesting to watch how people were able to forgive. And so there was this period where people just, you know, said, look, I'm sorry for what I did. And of course, they were given, you know, the Truth Commission would make a decision about whether or not a full submission was done, or whether there was integrity and honesty in the answers. And most of the time, people were very, very honest. I mean, out of the whole process, probably about two or three people only went to prison. And interestingly, no South Africans wanted revenge. Nobody wanted compensation. You know, so
they wanted to be acknowledged.
They just wanted to be acknowledged and heard. And so it was an opportunity to be heard.
Does that make you think about the term justice differently? Forgiveness and justice are never really ever in the same sentence. They are seen as two quite different things. Does it matter whether justice is really served, or is it more important for you to go through the process of understanding and acknowledging and about forgiveness?
Yeah, I don't think it's, for me, it's not just forgiveness, but it's not just justice, but it's restorative justice. That's important. In other words, where you actually get face to face with the person who committed the atrocity. And I wish they would do a lot more of this in our prisons, where people get to understand the consequences of what they've done and seen the pain that it's caused people. Because I think that more than long jail terms would do a lot more in our society. And so for me and for most of other people, it was that whole process of coming face to face with the person, and for them to make an honest submission about what they'd done and who'd given them orders, and showing remorse. Remorse was the big thing. Mm. Now, I suppose it's quite difficult to understand how you measure remorse. Is it the number of tears you cry? If you know, how do you measure it? But I think it was all recorded, it's all live on television, and many, many people felt a whole lot better.
You worked for Nelson Mandela for, was it 8 or 9 years?
9 years.
What was the reason that you moved away, or the change that you needed to make?
He retired. He announced his retirement. And I'd felt that I'd spent most of my life in standing up against apartheid. And I just wanted to do something different.
Yeah.
I wanted a different life. And so that was an opportune time for me to just say, okay, this is it. I'm, you know, calling time on my past. I wanted to move on. I wanted to start a family. I'd met my wife, who was not then my girlfriend, and she was living here. And this is how I ended up in the United Kingdom.
So when you moved to the UK, that must have been obviously another moment for you in your life where things changed. What, how did it compare? Because of all the things that you'd seen and been through in life, was things in the UK just different? Quite a much quieter life, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. A much, much quieter, more serene life. I thought I'd put distance between myself, my past, and living in the UK. But of course, I kept finding that it kept coming up. So I worked at the school one day. My wife was an IT manager, and we were having our second baby. And so the head asked me to come and help out because my other background is IT, my other passion. And got to the school, and the head of year six found out that I was from South Africa and I worked with Nelson Mandela, and they were studying Nelson Mandela, and got me to speak to the year six students, and they were blown away. And so the next part of my journey began. That was the catalyst for that happening, and I started getting invited by different schools and organizations, and that's how I ended up in Manchester. I met Peter and Donna, and they invited me to various conferences. I've been to schools, and this is what I do with my time, really just inspiring hope.
Do you feel that of all the things that you've seen and been through in life, you mentioned at that time when the guards had played Russian roulette, there was a voice inside your head that said, there's another path for you here. I've got some plans for you, that now you, all your experiences mean that you're fulfilling where life should be, or is there more that you feel that you need to do?
I think I am doing what I'm meant to be doing in terms of my past experience, because I think people may not go through what I went through, but I think whether people are suffering with depression or whether they've whether they are down about different things or whether they've had a setback in their lives, I think that the one constant that I always find is when I tell the story about my mom being thrown off the bench, I think everybody's had a mom. And so they can identify with that. And of course, when they compare and they see, if he could have got through all of that and come through, whatever it is I'm going to face in life, I can get through also. So whether it's students that are going through the A-level exams or GCSEs, they think, I'm very fortunate that I was able to go to a good school and get an education. There, this guy didn't get one, and yet he's still grateful to be alive. And so I think it instills, people begin to appreciate a lot more children, and they respond very, very well.
You talk about there in terms of strength and gratitude. We've mentioned forgiveness. Are there any things in your life that you regret?
No, I don't. I don't believe I regret anything. If I could change anything in my life, I wouldn't change anything, because I think I followed my heart and I did what I thought was right. And if I would do it all over again, I'd do it again.
Mm. Even the tough times.
Even the tough times, I would go through it again. Yeah. I wouldn't change anything. I wouldn't want to be born a different skin color, want to be fighting in the trenches with those who are struggling for freedom. So I have no regrets whatsoever.
What do you think about life today? You know, we look at the animosity which is happening overseas in America. A lot of the Christian community is very divided, for instance, over skin colour with relation to Donald Trump being president. Do you think that the message that Nelson Mandela taught you about forgiveness is very much needs to be still alive in present day when we look at what's happening, you know, in politics, for instance?
Yes, I do think so. And I think one of the big mistakes that people make in the West is, I think there's this quick, people think, well, let's just write Donald Trump off and nobody talk to him and nobody deal with him. And that's one of the biggest mistakes that we can make. It's almost like spraying perfume on a trash can. And what happens is that, and this I find with racists, is we always quickly want to shut them down. And I know we need to deal with them, but I think we need to engage with them and we need to point them in the right direction in terms of, and show them how wrong they were. So what I find societies, particularly in this country, is we quickly want to shut down people were racists instead of us engaging with them, and we spray this perfume on this trash can, they go away and they come out a superbug, and then we got to be dealing with a massive problem because we think we could just push away. So I just think the more people that engage with Donald Trump and others, the better I think our society would be, because I think the tendency these days is, well, let's just all avoid him. And because, I mean, the world is a horrible place at the moment. I mean, the racist genie has been let out of the bottle, sadly, and it's become cool again to be racist. Having said that, I just don't think we need to retreat and watch it all unfold. I just think, and again, the youth in America have led the way with the Never Again movement, where these ordinary students are standing up, taking a stand against gun violence, and it's young people. And I think we will see that these very, very young people that are standing up are the ones that will bring about change in America. It's just a matter of time. And they're not going to be helped by Facebook analytics or anything else. You're going to have these students who are going to stand up and they're going to make their voice counted.
Sounds like someone that we know.
Yes, I'm really, really pleased when I see that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of myself.
And we come back to that word hope, that there is hope within the younger generation that
Absolutely.
Wants to see a difference.
Absolutely, and I wish more and more young people would stand up and be counted and you know, just understand that it's in their hands. They can change the world. They can bring about change. They don't have to just sit down and complain. And that's one of the things that I hope that I accomplish in my various talks and visits to schools, is bringing about hope and understanding, getting people to understand, young people to understand that you can bring about the change. You can be the change, as Mahatma Gandhi said, you can be the change that you want to see. As Michael Jackson said, start with the boy or the girl in the mirror and make that change.
Where can people find out more about you, Chris?
Oh, they can go to my website, www.chrislubby.co.uk, and they'll see, I can find me on Twitter, at @Sawubona_Chris. Sawubona is a Zulu greeting. It means I see you. And I'm very, very active on Twitter and on Facebook. One thing I don't do is I don't get engaged. I don't engage with trolls. I just mute them or block them. I don't even talk to them. And I don't get involved in dissing people. If I don't have anything positive to say, I just won't say it.
Yep.
End of story. I'm not, you won't find me condemning Donald Trump or anything, because I just feel he's already taken up so much oxygen in the room.
Yeah.
Why should I give him more oxygen? And so that's not what you're going to find me doing.
You mentioned that as a child you dreamt of being a pilot. What are the dreams do you have for the future?
The dreams I have for the future is living in a world where human beings all over the world are treated with respect and dignity, because regardless of where it is, even today, even if it's, we think about the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, who were sadly treated very, very badly. These are refugees who have had to flee, and it was all based on religion. I mean, it's exactly the same experience that I had, based on race. And so I'd like to live in a world where I know that people are treated exactly the same, because of the fact that they're human beings. And it's got nothing to do with, you know, where you come from, who you are, sexual orientation, or any of that. I just, and that's the ideal, really, is to spread this word that there is another way.
You've been listening to Chris Labbe. It's spelt L-U-B-B-E on the Fuck It Moments podcast, a series brought to you by A Small Furry Bear Productions. You can find more details at asfbproductions.com. The programme is presented by me, Claire Freeman. The music is by Thomas Ragsdale. And we encourage you to come and connect with us on social media using the hashtag FimPod. Also, we'd really appreciate if you rate, review and subscribe to this series as we start to build a community, hoping to inspire and reach others who might need a teaspoon of motivation too. I'm always looking for new stories. If you've experienced a fuck it moment yourself, then tell me about it. The email is fimpod@gmail.com.